Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from one of the most influential filmmakers of his generation, Francis Ford Coppola. He sat down and talked with Milena Rysik of the New York Times for a literary arts special event in October 2017. Coppola was in Portland to support the publication of Live Cinema and Its Techniques. It's a book that explores the emergent art form of live cinema, in which movies will be performed live and sent instantly via satellite to be viewed in faraway theaters. And as this conversation looks forward toward this new form of filmmaking, it necessarily also takes us back as Coppola reflects on the grand arc of the whole art form, drawing on his vast knowledge and personal experience with some of the greatest actors, filmmakers, and artists alive in the last half century. For example, Coppola links this new art form to his early childhood watching the live TV of 1940s and 50s. We hear about these early films like The Outsiders and Rumblefish, and the incredible 4.5-year period in which he made The Godfather, The Godfather Part II, Apocalypse Now, and The Conversation. We hear some hilarious stories from both behind the scenes of some of the most important films ever made, and from Coppola's personal life. Above all, what I love about this conversation is how one really gets a sense of who Francis Ford Coppola really is, as a warm, empathetic, curious, and brilliant artist, as well as a parent, teacher, and husband, who has come to play a major role in shaping one of the defining art forms of our time. Here's Coppola.
Thank you all for joining us. I am so thrilled to be here with all of you and speaking with Francis. I will say right off the bat that I don't know enough about wine to talk about it, but we will talk mostly about movies and books and food and all that good stuff. So to get started, Francis, the book that you wrote, you know, you're at the stage in your career where people might be interested in a memoir. And the book that you wrote has some memoirish elements, but it's not quite a memoir. Can you tell people what live cinema is and why you wanted to make the unusual choice to write about it before you do it?
Well, when I began to think about the fact that over the last, 10 years, the form of filmmaking had very quietly but completely changed from being a mechanical and a photochemical process, literally a photography on celluloid that you cut with a scissor and glued together in different order for the editing, and that it was projected in the theater on big rolls of film, that I realized that over these last 12 years, beginning with sound and going through to editing until finally the complete process, including the photography, has become digital and electronic, it occurred to me that, well, this is a very big change. And although the movies that we're making with this new technology pretty much are as much like the older films that we all love, the truth of the matter is it's a totally different medium, and that if anyone sat and thought about it, perhaps this new method, this digital method of making films, might imply different kinds of films, films that wouldn't have been possible in the old mechanical photochemical era. And one of the aspects that it could be is that you could make cinema, you know, basically what we know as cinema, movies, and they could be made in a live performance, and that this old tradition of performance, which has been with the theater for thousands of years, wouldn't necessarily be lost, because no matter how you cut it today, most of the art we look at is recorded, or to say pejoratively, canned. And yet I thought back to the era when there were things as big and bigger production than our movies, with people very much like the modern movie director, which was, say, the 19th century opera tradition, when an opera house in Dresden would do this humongous production under the supervision of some kind of cinema director style person who supervised everything, possibly wrote it, was going to be the director of the music, but also supervised the production design, the choreography of the ballet. But then after months and expenditure of great amounts of money, months of rehearsal, actually stood up in front of the audience and raised his baton and performed it live for the audience. How memorable that must have been, to have been there when they first did La Traviata or Aida or The Flying Dutchman or what have you. But much of the work that is the most, in a way, pertinent to contemporary time is not performed. And this new electronic digital format would enable, with technology that hadn't existed, say, even 10 years ago or 5 years ago, technology that was invented for sports, that it might be possible that you could do basically live cinema. And you know, of course, there was a thing called live television, and it was even known in the 50s as the golden age of television, the wonderful live productions that they did before it was possible to record video, the work especially of John Frankenheimer, by the way, to whom I dedicate this book as the earliest pioneer of live cinema. But live television wasn't quite what I'm talking about. All of you who perhaps turn on a television and are seeing what's on, and then you come to a movie, you know instantly that it's cinema. It looks different, it behaves differently, the way it's told is different. There's no confusion that it's not some new live production of a musical, or it's not Young and the Restless, it's cinema. And it behaves like cinema, so we know what it is. But imagine if what you're seeing qualifies in your mind as cinema, yet it's being performed live, so there is the element of performance. So I became interested in that possibility. So I decided this time I'm not going to go and find myself looking at 25 helicopters, scratching my head, how do I do this? But rather I was maybe do a what we call a proof of concept, to do a couple of experimental workshops. And I found one college in Oklahoma, in Oklahoma City, that I thought of because an old colleague of mine was teaching there, and I had gone several times to help them raise money to build a film school facility, so I knew it had the facility. And I thought I could go there and be part of the curriculum. They would give me 70 students to work on a live cinema workshop and just try to do it and see what it was, what were the issues, what were the problems, was it even possible, was it worth it? And I had a wonderful experience with those students. It's wonderful to work with young people who don't know what it is you can't do. But that was their attitude. They were totally into it, and we did it.
One of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you say in the book that you're not sure whether it is worth it.
Yeah, well, that's the question of whether or not performance is worth it, you know. And then, encouraged by that, I went then to a year and a half later, and I thought, well, I want to do that again, but I want to make it more difficult. Now, those of you who worked in film know that the things you want to avoid is you want to avoid period whenever you can, because it means all the clothes and all the hairdress, all the hairstyles, and everything needs to be hand-wrought, so to speak. And then you don't want to have any babies in it. Babies are extremely controlled by the state. A baby is only allowed to work 20 minutes. And therefore, most babies in movies are a set of twins, because then you can work them for 40 minutes. And you don't want any animals, dogs, cats, but especially in any exotic animals. And you don't want to have any stunts. So I decide and you want to stay away from difficulty of like foreign languages with subtitles. So the second attempt I
did. I see where this is going.
The second attempt I did all the things you shouldn't do in a movie, because for live cinema, you have to really rehearse. That means you need the baby, you need the goat, you need the stuff. And then when you do it, you need the hairdressers to do all the hundreds of extras and stuff. So I made it as hard as I could at the UCLA, and we did it, and repeated the same experimental proof of concept again with students, And there were some interesting side notes to that, which I'm happy to talk about, which I'll tell you, having to do with the fact that in most film schools in the world, in all film schools in the world, where there are, is a film school and a theater school, the two departments in sort of hate each other, and they don't work together, although you would think it's unnatural that they would work together, but I'll talk about that, because UCLA had exactly that situation.
Well, a lot of, you talk about in the book your respect for actors, and a lot of filmmakers kind of view actors as simply a vessel to tell their story, but you say actors have the toughest job that there is to use your body.
And we can talk about that. So in summation, I was going on a trip with my wife and on a boat, and I just found every day I wanted to write down what I had learned. I didn't have any intention to write a book, but write down a book to make sure I could remember all the rules that, and things that I hadn't expected, write it down. And then when I came back, I noticed a letter from a publisher who said, well, if you ever want to write a memoir, we'd love to be involved. And I sent them these notes from my experience. I said, well, this is a textbook. I don't think it's what you want, but so they were interested in it, and that's how we are here tonight.
I think we're all glad that you landed here. One thing I'm curious about this, you know, you say that this idea came to you when you were thinking about the transition from film to digital, but it was also something that was born in your youth when you were watching some of the great, you know, live TV of the era, and you were kind of trapped in your room. You had polio as a child and ended up watching a lot of TV.
Well, in the course of course, once I had sent these notes, the publisher said, well, could you write a chapter as to why you're so interested? And I had to place it in time, that I was born in 1939, I lived in New York. My father was a classical musician. And he was always—he was the son of an interesting man who was a tool and die maker, but interested in, you know, engineering and science. In fact, his first son was named Archimedes, which tells you the mood in our family. And my father was always coming home with something from New York that was a wire recorder or a tape recorder. And in 1945 or 1946, at the latest, he came home with a television. And I was, of course, just, as you can imagine, I was, a six-year-old kid. I was just enthralled, although most of the programming was a TV test pattern in those days. But I remember very vividly television, and I was obsessed with it. And then later, I was part of the 1949 polio epidemic, and I was paralyzed, couldn't walk, couldn't move my left arm, and in those early treatment days of infantile paralysis, there was one school of thought that pinned you to the bed every few inches with a safety pin so you wouldn't move and further damage the muscles. And I was a prisoner of television without a remote control. And I just watched television, and of course no child would go near a kid who had polio, so I had no friends and just watched television. I played with puppets and the tape recorder and the toy movie projector for about a year and a half. And so throughout my life, I was interested in television. And then when I saw the productions of the 50s, the wonderful Playhouse 90 and all these classic golden age of television, especially the work of John Frankenheimer, whose work always had a cinematic touch to it. So I outlined the fact that in my life I was always just drawn to live television and what you could do with live television. I found it very exciting.
You had a moment on live television yourself at the Oscars in 1979 that kind of prophesied some of this stuff, if people were paying attention to that speech that you gave, but you gave it under unusual circumstances.
Well, I was a friend of Bill Graham, the wonderful rock impresario, who actually himself was a wonderful actor and was very interested in being an actor. And he just wanted to go to the Oscars in the worst way. So having some tickets for myself and my wife to go to the Oscars, my wife and family went, but they sat in the crummy seats, and I went with Bill Graham because I was going to make a presentation. In the course of it, he started eating these cookies. And of course, I never won to have someone eating something while I couldn't. I took it, I said, let me have one of those. And he said, no. And I had no idea. So, you know, 15, 20 minutes later, they came and said to me, go up and your time, I was going to give the award for best director with Ally McGraw as my co-person. And I started to feel a little, you know, I don't know, levitated or something. And so they said, and now, and I was supposed to say, and now the award for the best director. Instead, I turned to the audience and I said, we're about to embark on a change of the cinema. And I went on and on, and Ally McGraw was there like with their mouth open, and the audience, and I nervously was scratching my beard. And I basically told them, this is like 40 years ago, that the cinema was gonna change, that it was all gonna be digital electronics, and that you were gonna be able to do things and make effects and stuff that you couldn't imagine, that there'd be no limits at all. And of course, I was greatly ridiculed for saying this, but everything I said came absolutely true.
Yeah, you had a vision somewhere J.J. Abrams was watching. One of the things you talk about in the book is that the projects that you're making, that you're doing this sort of lifelong fulfillment with live cinema, is scripts based on your own family story.
Well, that's how the notion of really doing it, I'd always tempted. In fact, I tell the story of how I ended up making One from the Heart, which I really meant to be live cinema. I wanted it to be live at a time when the technology couldn't quite do it. To get to why I suddenly got very serious to the point where I said, well, I should do some workshops and see if I ought to, you know, learn before I leap, was because I, at my age, I decided that the thing I wanted to write was a kind of story not unlike those of you who know Buddenbrooks, which was the first novel of Thomas Mann, who wrote a sort of three-generation story of a family much like his during a time when the Hanseatic League in Germany began to change into what became modern Germany. And I thought, well, maybe what I could do is write the three generations of my own family, Italian immigrants, who came to New York and who were both involved in mechanics and engineering. My grandfather was the man who built the Vitaphone that made the first movies speak. He didn't invent the system, but he engineered and built the actual machine that made the Vitaphone. And my father and other uncles were all classical musicians involved in the theater and in early what became television. So I thought I could write three generations of my family, the Coppola family, set against the birth and rise and ultimately what became television and its very profound influence on our lives. And I wanted to write something that would really nail that period of my lifetime. And I always thought that, like, say, La Dolce Vita so beautifully caught the spirit of the 50s that if a Martian were to come to Earth and he said, tell me, what was the 50s like? I say, see La Dolce Vita, and you'll get it. The paparazzi, when celebrity kind of became more important than Christianity. It's all in La Dolce Vita. So I thought the thing that I wanted to do as the last piece of work I did in my life was perhaps this, taking the great inspiration of Buddenbrooks and applying it to a family like my own, that maybe I could write something like that. And the more I wrote it and I realized that television was a character in it, I thought, well, wouldn't it be appropriate if I made it in live television? And so that's what led me to seriously look at, well, how would I do it? How do I know I could do it? And so that's why I did these workshops.
Well, we know your filmmaking process has changed because you're doing these tests, but has your writing process changed at all? Or has this particular piece of writing, have you approached it differently because it is so personal?
you know, I learned a few things about writing in my career. As some of you may know, I started out as a screenwriter. I was a playwriting major. I was a theater major in a drama department. I was there was no such thing as a cinema department. In fact, at my college, I tried to start a cinema workshop, and I think three people came to my first meeting. One was my girlfriend. What I learned from my long career as a screenwriter is to choose a time of day during which you want to write. For me, it's early in the morning when I first wake up and I sit down in a place where I have an orderly desk and my coffee. And I like the early morning because no one's yet up to call me up and hurt my feelings. And I can write if my feelings are not hurt. If someone hurts my feelings, I'm doomed. And I also learned from the time I was a young screenwriter that when you write, when you're a young person, or maybe any writer, that as you work, there's a hormone that's secreted into your body that makes you hate what you're writing.
True. I think that's true, yeah. As a writer, yes.
So I learned to write the 6 pages or whatever, you know, was my daily session, and put the pages down and not read them until I felt I had, you know, completed at least the first pass, and then sit down with great ceremony and read them. And the thinking of that is very, very good, because in truth, you know, if you read them, you would hate it, and then you would want to rewrite it, and you'd want to change it, and you'd never get out of the first 10 or 12 pages. Whereas when you read the whole, you might realize, well, you're just going to cut those out, that the story really starts on page 16, or that the 10 pages are fine the way they are, or the benefit of perspective that you get. So the second rule, aside from this daily work ritual of the same time, get there, put in your 3, 4, 5 hours, whatever you're allowed to expend, but also to not judge it and to get a hunk of it to the end, and then look at it and read it, and then begin the rewrite. Of course, there are many rewrites. So my writing process really has never changed ever since I learned that basic procedure.
One thing that you've said that you think about in making your own films, and a piece of advice you gave your children, also, of course, also filmmakers, is to think about a theme. Think about the theme for the project.
Well, that's something also as a director you need to have. There's usually some core that, for example, as a director, which is, you know, similar to what you do as a writer, a director is called upon to make 100,000 decisions a day, you know. She should have short hair, not long hair. She should wear slacks, not a dress. It should be a little sports car, not a Prius. It ought to be they're constantly asking you, and most of what they ask you is just your gut reaction, which is a very good thing, to stay in touch with that intuitive part of you. But sometimes they ask you questions and you don't know the answer. But if you know the core or the essence or the theme in a word or two, then that can help you. Well, for example, The Godfather was about succession. The conversation was about privacy. Apocalypse Now was about morality. So on the conversation, when they said, well, what kind of coat do you want him? Do you want him to look like a detective? Should he have like a Humphrey Bogart trench coat? And they showed me coats, and I didn't know which one to pick, but I said, well, so when I don't know what decision to make, I ask myself, well, what does the theme suggest? And there was one coat which was a transparent raincoat. And I said, well, the theme is privacy, so wouldn't it be interesting if you could see through his coat? And that's how I arrived at making that decision. But that's also how you might decide what style the music would be for the movie. In the case of, again, since we're on the conversation, it was a movie about privacy, and it was a very lonely character, so I chose a single piano to be the thing. It's the same thing for a writer. If you have the essence of what you feel the whole thing really rotates around, because, you know, a screenplay is a form more like a short story than a novel, because it's meant to be consumed in one sitting. So it has to be written with a sort of economy And so the more you know what the theme is that you can tell yourself, even if you don't know exactly how you're going to develop it, that can sort of bind it together for you.
So when you started to direct The Godfather, you were 29 years old. That was a film that came to you to direct, and you had a lot of different ideas than the studio about how you wanted to make the film. The studio didn't want you to have Marlon Brando in the film. They definitely didn't want you to have Pacino.
Well, they didn't want it to be a period picture, because a period picture, if it was set in the 40s, that meant all the cars had to be difficult to obtain. The hairstyles, you had all those hairstylists, the clothes. Period pictures are much more expensive than a movie shot in the time of the actual. So they wanted it to be shot in the 70s, and the script was like that. It had hippies in it. And I felt that the fact that the story was set in the 40s, right at that moment when America was about to become this extraordinary world power after World War II, I thought that was important. So, of course, I also thought it should be shot in New York, which is where the book was set, but they wanted it to be shot in St. Louis because it would be, so they wanted it to be in St. Louis in the 70s, and I wanted to be in New York in the 40s. So already we got off to a bad start.
So I wonder how you had the gumption. I mean, you had some success in the industry at that point, but you were 29. You were doing a film that you already had come to realize was going to be a big picture. How did you have the gumption to fight the studio on those choices?
I didn't have much success at all. My only strength was my utter weakness. You know, we were up in San Francisco. We were trying to have an independent company. My then assistant, who was really becoming more of a like a younger brother to me, was George Lucas, says, Francis, they're gonna chain up the door of our place, of our, we had a, American Zoetrope had a facility, and we haven't paid, you know, any of the bills, so you have to do this thing they're offering you, just do it and get the money, and he was right, I had to do it, so ultimately I accepted what was an offer of a job. I thought I was getting fired every 3 weeks. Ironically, it was a disastrous experience. I was so bummed out throughout the whole thing. And basically, it changed my life. And a guy who wanted really to be an independent, personal, experimental filmmaker ended up as a big shot for having made The Godfather. Crazy.
So you mentioned that the experience of filming that movie was not fun for you, and of course everybody knows, you know, the stories of Apocalypse Now and the difficulties filming that. So two of your most iconic films, you know, the experiences of making them were fairly treacherous for you. Have you, watching them now or thinking about them now, have you had the distance to be able to appreciate them in another way?
Well, as I think, I was always so miserable and so scared and so over my head, but as I look back, in the 70s, I realized that I made The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather Part II, and Apocalypse Now straight through in 4.5 years, one after the other. And I was... And I was utterly despondent. And my wife will attest to the fact that really every movie I ever worked on, I was miserable, although I like to think I enjoyed Rumblefish, but she reminds me that I was not in very good mood during that. So movie making, all of you who have done it know, is tough and it's scary. I mean, an artist. There are those with God-gift talent. I think there are some filmmakers, I think, just have that knack that they were born with, and it comes to them as second nature, but there are the other ones like me who really struggle and suffer and are filled with self-doubt about it, and that's the other way to go at it, I suppose.
You talk about in the book that the cinematographers on Godfather and Apocalypse Now had different ideas about how to use the camera. and the Apocalypse, Apocalypse Now cinematographer Vittorio Storaro. He wanted the camera to move like a pen seamlessly through the film. And Gordon Willis on The Godfather had an interesting idea. He said, you shouldn't, every scene in the film shouldn't contain everything it needs. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to cut to the next scene.
Exactly.
And some actors also have an idea that they should sort of hold back a little bit in the performance to keep the audience wanting more. What's your take?
Well, you know, actors, there's a whole chapter about actors because I feel much about acting is misunderstood. I especially don't like it when people say to me, or I hear regarding other, how did you get that performance out of that actor? You don't get a performance out of the actor. The actor gives you the performance. You're like a coach. You're there to encourage and to stimulate and to maybe say a wise word at a crucial moment, but the actor is out there alone and the actor is doing it. I devoted a chapter in this book to all the things you do with actors and how you can talk to them and how you create a safe space for them. You know, there's lots of talk about, and I'm asked myself, well, who are the difficult actors you worked with? The truth of the matter is that if you work with an actor who is being very difficult, who comes in a surly mood or is always late or argues with you about the text, usually 9 times out of 10, he's scared. And so if you let that actor know how much you believe in them, all those problems go away.
People maybe would be curious to know that one of the first things you did for The Godfather was to stage an improv rehearsal with the cast for The Godfather at Patsy's, the restaurant in New York, when they were all nervous to meet Brando.
Yeah, it was the first time they met Brando. And I got a table to look, be laid out like a family dining room table. And Marlon, they hadn't met him, and he sat at the head of the table, and to his left was Jimmy Caan, and to his right was Al Pacino, and then Johnny Casal was the next one over, and Bobby Duvall was the next one over, and Tally was the young girl of the family. She served the food. And of course, Jimmy Caan was just making jokes and being, you know, sort of outrageous. And every time Marlon looked away, Bobby Duvall would do Marlon Brando imitations. And Pacino was just being very intense and what have you. And Johnny Casal was just a lovable person that he naturally was. And at the end of that dinner, the family existed. You know, I like there to be a time, a week or so, where you can't screw up, you just get to know each other and have fun, and no one is gonna say, oh, you did it bad. I have one rule that you have to be in character the whole time. And you know, you think that's easy, and it's as though I won't tolerate them saying, oh, my character doesn't like caviar. He has to say, I don't like caviar. And although that sounds dumb and easy to do, it's exhausting to be someone else for 8 hours a day. It really is tiring.
Are there pitfalls, though, to having your performers in character all the time? I mean, did you
during
learn
rehearsal?
Yeah.
I can't think of it. Can you? No, it's like, you know, when you go to the gym and you're working out, they're working out is what they're doing. And they're making it possible that the actor will invite the character to come and inhabit them by doing that. Also, I give memories to the actor. For example, let's say you're an actress and there's an actor and you're going to be a married couple. Well, if it's a real married couple, we have a whole bankload of memories of when I first met you, when we first broke up, when we got back together, when you heard I was sick, but then I got better. You know, there's a whole bunch of memories in any relationship, just not a husband and wife. So the rehearsal is a chance through improvisation to give you those memories. You could say, okay, let's do and with improvisation, you always do this little tricky thing of you tell each one in private, okay, I want you to see if you can borrow $10 from her. And you tell the other one, well, you know, he owed you $5,000 for 3 years. He never mentions it. But they don't know each other, what you've told them. So then you say, okay, you're sitting at the cafeteria and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's that instance. But in that way, you can give the memory, not about the money, but you always give the actors in an improvisation usually a different intention to go for. But by doing that, even though it doesn't come out in the story, there's a richness there because they have those memories that which you provided. It's almost like deposits in an emotional bank account through improvisation. So improvisation and theater games, all those things are fun. It teaches you that, you know, the work is not scary, and they should abandon fear, and it builds up a sense of an ensemble, and then you march in, and of course, in the case of live cinema, you start giving run-throughs of whole acts at a time. It's pretty amazing to see how that's done.
Well, you mentioned earlier that The Godfather changed your life, and it certainly had an impact on people all over the world. And one of the things I learned backstage that you have been approached by even political leaders who found it.
Yeah, all for some reason, all the political leaders of the world loved The Godfather. Saddam Hussein loved The Godfather. It was his famous movie. Donald Trump's one of his favorites. Every time he saw me, Donald Trump would go, number one, number one, he would say. All of them.
And you had some interactions with some of them around The Godfather.
Well, I assume that's why they paid attention to want to see this kid from, I can't say this skinny kid from Queens anymore, but that's what I was. But the story I told Milena was that 10 years ago, I was with my granddaughter. We were invited. We were in Romania looking to, I was going to make a film in Romania. I didn't make a film. My granddaughter was 19, and she was traveling with me, and we were invited to have lunch with Mr. Putin in Russia. And so we went to the Kremlin, and so Gia was just, oh, it's like a palace, you know, and these guys, soldiers walking around. She was so impressed, and we were going to go have lunch with them. And then they said, well, Mr. Putin is happy you're here, but the granddaughter can't go because in the diplomatic world, he would have had to have a daughter or a child to be in. And I said, don't worry, she's terrified being here, and she just wants to sit out and look at the Kremlin. Inside the Kremlin is a pretty impressive palace. So about 5 minutes, 10 minutes before we were going in, they said, oh, he said, you know, bring her, she's welcome. So I brought my little granddaughter, and we went in, and there was a lunch just with Putin, and a fantastic spread. And he spoke wonderful English. He was extremely charming. He was very gracious with my granddaughter. And, you know, I, of course, it was just at the time that we were invading, I guess, Iraq or something. And in those days, that was the famous moment when Bush had looked into the eyes of Putin and thought he was wonderful. So I asked a lot of questions of what he thought of our government, and he was a very, very intelligent guy, and he wasn't too impressed with any of our leaders except one. He really liked Colin Powell, and he said that to me, and we talked about a lot of things, and I was very favorably impressed, mainly because he was so kind to, and the lunch was really good. So at one point, did I get a little glint of what was really there when I said to him, you know, I was here during the Soviet times, and Moscow was so dark in those days, and you couldn't really go anywhere and have a sandwich. You couldn't get a cup of coffee in Moscow. You had to go inside of a hotel. I said, now it's almost as good as New York. And he said, it's better than New York. So I kind of got the...
Did he do a Brando impression?
He didn't do a Brando impression. No. But then when I came out, I said to my granddaughter, I said, gee, I could have just jumped over the table and gotten him. He says, well, I'm glad you didn't, because he knows judo.
You mentioned your granddaughter, Gia. She is a filmmaker also, of course.
Yeah, she made her first film called Palo Alto when she was just, you know, what was she, 20-something.
Did you have a sense that you were going to be the scion of this filmmaking family? Of course, you come from a filmmaking family in some respects, or TV family yourself.
Well, I like to say that my granddaughter, Gia, represents the Coppola's fifth generation of the movie industry, if you include my grandfather, Augustino, who built the Vitaphone, which does, I would think, include him. Also, my other grandfather, Francesco Panino, owned the movie theater, and used to import Italian movies into the theater. So indeed, this family has been connected in one way or another of the cinema for five, and that's about as many generations as you can have, almost. Maybe you could have six generations if we were there in 1890, which we weren't.
So did you know that you were going to have more filmmaking generations in your family?
Well, I've been...
You took your kids on set.
Yeah, I've been married 54 years. And I used to be a drama counselor when I was 17 to do little plays with 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds, and I've always loved children. Maybe it comes from, I went to so many schools as a kid that I never had a friend in school because I'd be in and out of the school in 3 months, and then I had polio, which means I was sort of a contagious person in the minds, perhaps. So I've always loved children, and so when I was so fortunate to have children when I was in my early 20s, I just agreed with my wife that if ever I had to go on a job somewhere for more than 2 weeks, I wanted to take the kids out of school and take them with us. And we did. We took them out of school like that. Now you can't do it. The school won't let you back in if you try to do it today. But we took them with us to Sicily. We took them to Dominican Republic then. And they went on what we thought was going to be a year, 6 months in the Philippines on apocalypse. And we were there for a year and a half, or at least. So the kids were always on the set, and it was as though the art director or the costume chief were the uncles and aunts, and would make little doll clothes for Sophia, and Roman was always in there with the makeup man coming out with one eye blown away. And so our kids, we were like a acrobatic family, and whenever we need a kid, like if we needed a baby on The Godfather in the baptism scene, we had just had Sophia, so Sophia was the baby in The Godfather when she was just a little newborn, and Sophia was in movies all, but like you pull your own kid when you need a kid because you have them there. So we were like a family of Chinese acrobats. But as a result, the kids have been around movies all their lives, so it sort of makes sense that they would all move in that direction. Sophia, in particular, was interesting because she was a very precocious kid, and she loved fashion. And when she was just, 9 years old, she had so many subscriptions to fashion magazines. And whenever we went to New York, we took her. Ellie, my wife, was always, she said, well, I want to see this designer. And it turned out it was the young Marc Jacobs or the young whoever, these people who became fashion icons. And I remember once she looked at me, she was in her 20s, and she said, oh, Daddy, am I just a dilettante? I want to be a painter. She was studying painting in college. I want to be a painter, and I love fashion. And I love fashion photography, and I want to write stories. Am I just a dilettante? And I said, no, it's a mistake when parents want their kids to choose what they're going to be. That's usually for, economic reasons. They want you to be an accountant, or they want you to get a teaching credential when you're young, or be a doctor, because those are all good, solid professions. But the truth of the matter is, I don't think young people ought to choose their professions too early. I think they should do everything they love on the theory that when they do decide what it is they want to do, all those things that they were touching are going to be useful. And that's what happened with Sophia at the age of, quite young. She made a short film, a long short film, and it was just wonderful. And I realized she's the director. And all those things, painting and fashion, all are elements in her work. So each of the kids in their own way. And then, of course, when my granddaughter, she, of course, never got to meet her father, who died before she was born. But he was the first of my kids who wanted to be a director. So the little granddaughter sort of just ate up everything that was left from her father, his photography and his films. and the work he had done and his letters, and she wanted to be a director so she could be like her father.
That's wonderful. So we're getting to the moment where we're going to have audience questions, but before we get to that, I want to do a quick lightning round. Is that okay? Can we do a lightning round of questions?
I give a short answer is what you're saying.
That's it. So I'm gonna go over some lines from the book, and I just wanna get a little sense from you. So one of the things that I love in the book, you say, all art cheats.
That was in regard to documentaries and the fact that probably Nanook of the North, when he caught a fish, someone put the fish on the, didn't really catch it.
The memorable moment is often unspoken.
Well, dialogue is the first thing that keeps an audience away, but something that happens unspoken between actors really can touch you.
You're doing really well in this lightning round. You know, who knew you had it in?
Told me the rules.
And you also write in the book that one of the keys to your happiness is pasta fazool. And I want to hear some other ones.
Oh, that's a joke that I have a 100-year-old uncle who's a miracle, who's still writing operas and just can do everything. And he always says the secret to marriage when they ask, because he's been married a million years and his wife is so, he always says, pasta fazool, that's the secret. Your question is, you want to hear other...
Some of your other secrets to happiness.
Oh, that's a question. That's a tough one to do as a lightning. Secret of happiness is that the people you love are healthy.
Very good. And on that note, I think we will go to the audience Q&A. So we have some questions. What was it like working with actors from community theaters for your live cinema workshops?
That's interesting. In Oklahoma, we did cast from some community theater efforts in Oklahoma City and in Dallas, which is a pretty short commute. And they were, there were very few to choose from, and they were really troopers. And of course, at UCLA, many of the actors in the UCLA version were students. And since I did a lot of the UCLA film in the Neapolitan dialect, because I wanted to make it hard, we then had to find actors who could speak Nabalidan, so that was interesting. Generally, if you bring the actors together and they get very gung ho and they're wonderful, they're really your asset.
So somebody asks, can you tell one positive story about and the influence that your mother had on you?
Well, my mother was the one who made the magic in the family. My mother is the one who made those unforgettable Christmases where we would come in the room and Santa Claus had come. And I believed that there was a Santa Claus till I was 13 because it was so beautiful and stacks of presents had come. My mother made all that magic.
Several people are asking, what advice would you give young filmmakers to improve writing skills or research for scripts or just in general?
I always joke about that because very often a young man used to ask me, what should I do? I want to get in the film business. And I would say, get married. And aside from it being maybe amusing, but there's a reason. It's because when I was young and I was married and had kids, I was very deathly serious about coming through for my family and being, I realize the Coppola family now has become among the great families in the movie business and stuff, but believe me, I came to Hollywood, no one ever heard of a Coppola, and I didn't know one person in the movie business, and I was just there on by the skin of my teeth. And so when I had a wife and a son and then another son, I really wanted to come through for them. And so I was very diligent. I would stay up late to finish scripts, and I wasn't out cavorting around as very often the youth at the time were doing. So when I joke to a young man and say, "We'll get married," it's because you suddenly really are up against it, and you're the provider, and it's a very good incentive. If I'm talking nowadays to a young woman who asked me that question, I say, don't get married.
So somebody asked, he said that he read that Picasso once said that he can see the painting that he's going to make, and you're wondering, can you see the film that you're going to make?
Yes and no. For me, it's in the form of a kind of a hunch. It's something I can't see and I can't explain, but I know it. And sometimes it's revealed later on in a dream, but it's a hunch that's a good hunch that I know if I continue working around it, it will come about and will come to be.
And I'll add just one thing that we were talking about backstage. You said that one of the reasons you get involved in projects is because things take a long time and you get bored.
Well, that's true. You know, like right now, I'm in the middle of what I think is a very... Also, I think all my life, I've basically been a depressed kid. I was a lonely kid. I didn't have any friends. I was always in trouble with my father. So I was always depressed. And I think I started to become interested in projects to distract me from my state of being depressed. And I notice even now, if I'm just waiting for something, that depression comes back, and of course, modern treatment of depression is to give you drugs, which I don't want an antidepressant. So instead, I invent another project, and then I get all excited about it. So it's a self-medication.
I think that we're all glad that you decide to treat yourself with that kind of creative outlet. Thank you all for joining us. You've been a terrific audience.
That was Francis Ford Coppola in conversation with Milena Ryzik as part of a Literary Arts special event in October 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.